Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 24th, 2001. In the fireside room is Catherine Cummings Bond. Today's session number is CUC 2001-05, and it's titled Woman of Strength and Power, Florence Nightingale. Let's listen in.
Oh, don't ask me that. I'm 18, sure.
What?
20. 20.
I thought she needed to. All right. I'm going to sit down for my beloved friend, partially because I saw a bear today. I'm a little bit shaky, but not terribly shaky, but also because Florence was infirmed most of her life. Did you know that? She spent most of her life in bed. And so it would be, I should probably be lying down, but I couldn't get a bed in here. So I'm going to sit here and take Florence.
Put your feet up if you want.
I could, but I'm not going to put my feet up. Alrighty. How many of you are nurses? One. Alrighty. Did anyone ever... No, none of you were around when she was alive, so no one met her. But I would like for you to meet... isn't that great, Katie? She is a nurse. I'm going to begin and tell you the story of Florence Nightingale. I am Florence Nightingale. And I am proud to say that I am a nurse. My English parents were William and Fanny Nightingale, who were married in 1819, when it was fashionable for wealthy folks to go on long trips to Europe. My parents were on the continent for 3 years for their honeymoon, and my older sister and I were born there. I was named after the lovely city of Florence, Italy. How many of you ever been to Florence, Italy? Well, so you know where my name came from. When I was 1 year old, we returned to England, where my family spent time near London at our two country estates. Both had beautiful grounds and many pets, not to mention cousins to play with. I had a glorious time growing up. Until my sister and I were 12, we were taught by a governess, and then my father took over our education. My sister and I learned classical and modern languages, history and mathematics, which was my favorite. It was a far better education than most girls of my day received. Today, nurses are revered as upstanding, dedicated professionals, but they were not always. In my day, Charles Dickens, perhaps you've heard of him, characterized a nurse as the following. A nurse is a frowsy, drunken slattern who would steal pillows from beneath the head of her unconscious patient to soften her chair. That's what nurses were thought of. Nurses' social status was considered beneath that of a kitchen maid. So how did I sink to the low depths as the daughter of one of the wealthy aristocracy? Well, let me tell you the story. Very early, I began visiting the poor and the sick near our home in England. Some say I inherited this from my grandfather, who was William Smith, whose desire was to help those less fortunate, and was sympathetic, generous, passionate, and most philanthropic. I knew that England was in the Deep Depression. Our home was lovely and parties abounded, but just outside of our gates, starvation and misery stalked the English countryside and the streets of London. When I was 16 years old, I heard a call to serve God. But what did God want me to do? I wasn't sure, but I was willing and eager to follow God's calling. At 17, my family again visited the European continent. In Paris, an English woman invited me to meet French dukes, English peers, and other important people. I frankly was not impressed by any of them. But in Geneva, I encountered some Italian exiles who had had to flee their country. I was thrilled and starry-eyed, listening to their stories with great interest. When Dr. Samuel Howe, an American philanthropist, visited our family, I found I liked him better than most of my parents' friends. He was sympathetic to my interests, and I asked Dr. Howe, "Do you think, Dr. Howe, it would be unsuitable and unbecoming for a young English woman to devote herself to works of charity in hospitals and elsewhere, as Catholic sisters do?" Dr. Howe's response was this, "My dear Miss Florence, It would be unusual, and in England, whatever is unusual is unsuitable, but I say to you, Miss Nightingale, go forward. His words inspired me. So while my older sister went to balls and parties, I found pleasure in caring for the sick, my grandmother and my old nurse, and the poor villagers. I told my family that I planned to study nursing in a hospital just a few miles away. My mother had hysterics. My sister became furious, and my father was discontented. You see, hospitals in the 1840s were staffed mainly by hospital nuns or by women from the lowest dregs of humanity. Hospitals in London had degraded conditions where filth, stench, and total lack of fresh air and disregard of patients' needs flourished. Rich people never visited the hospitals. They kept their sick at home. It was a much safer place to keep them. Only the poor and the destitutes would use hospitals. I was Florence Nightingale, the refined, well-educated, and well-traveled daughter of a respected family. Me, working in a hospital as a nurse? Well, the idea was unspeakable to my family and all of my acquaintances. During my travels in Germany, I met Pastor Fliebner, founder of the great Lutheran Hospital at Kaisenwerth near Dusseldorf on the Rhine. Pastor Fliebner was a man of unbounding energy and enterprise. His parish was poor and sinking into oblivion. He could not stand by and watch his life's work disintegrate for lack of funds. He was filled with a desire to help the unfortunate people, and so he began a refuge for discharged prison women because he saw how impossible it was for them to rehabilitate themselves. Later, he opened a hospital and home for insane women and an orphanage. This man was a saint, as well as a home for nurses who needed a place to live after their work was done. Studies under Pastor Fliebner were such an inspiration. I rose at 5 a.m. I scrubbed floors, I took care of the orphans, and I assisted the doctor in operations at the hospital. This simple life and hard work didn't bother me at all. In fact, I had never been happier in all of my life. I had the privilege of meeting Dr. Elizabeth Blackwell. Does anyone know who that is? Oh, good. She was America's first woman doctor. She stayed with me after she'd lost her eye. I found Liz, as I called her, Dr. Blackwell, more sympathetic than any woman I'd ever met, and opened up my heart to her. I shared how when I looked at any row of windows, I would think how I could turn it into a hospital, and just where I would place the beds. Now, perhaps this was God's call for me. Well, I suppose you're wondering about my love life. Many people ask about it. A few of London's most eligible bachelors fell in love with me. One was Richard Monckton Milnes, who was a member of Parliament, a trustee in the British Museum, and a biographer of Keats. At first, I was interested in him as well. But in the end, I knew that to be his wife, my main task would be to be a hostess at his elaborate dinner parties. So I rejected his marriage proposal. This didn't make my family happy either. You see, I'd grown to be quite independent. In 1853, when I was just 33, I went to London in defiance of my family, accepting a post as, this is the title, superintendent for the institution of the care of sick gentlewomen in distressed circumstances. I like to see you getting that one of those little pins you put on. There I did what others thought unusual. I had hot water piped into every floor. I had a dumbwaiter installed to move food, and I insisted on clean beds and wholesome meals. This was a flash for them. The wealthy philanthropic women of the Anglican Church wanted only, quote, sick gentlewomen, unquote, meaning Protestant, and preferably not poor. I battled them until they admitted Catholic, Jewish, and poor women. This was my first victory over prejudice. When a cholera epidemic broke out in London, I took a leave of absence to volunteer at Middlesex Hospital. Here, patients were women of the slums. Day after day, these poor women were brought in, filthy, wretched, and half crazed with fear and pain. I worked day and night to try to save as many as I could, and when the epidemic was over, I returned to the institution for gentlewomen. The Crimean War had begun the preceding year when England and France declared war on Russia. Before a shot was fired, the English ranks were swept with cholera. In the London Times, I read a series of articles by one of the first war correspondents about a hospital in Scutari, where English casualties from the Crimean War were being housed. The articles shocked everyone, but especially me. One of the articles read, "There is not the least attention paid to decency or clean linens. The stench is appalling. The fetid air can hardly struggle out of the building to taint the atmosphere, and the men die without the least bit of effort being made to save them." Then the article appealed directly to me. It said, are there any of the daughters of England in this extreme hour of need ready for such a work of mercy? Well, within hours, I began organizing a group of nurses to go with me to Scutari. I called on an old friend, who is now the Secretary of War, to inform him that we were planning to leave in a few days. At the exact time I made my visit to him, he was sending for me as, quote, "the one woman in England capable of supervising the nurses." My appointment was called Superintendent of the Female Nursing Establishment of the English General Hospital in Turkey. Even my parents were impressed enough to not object to this one. Now, I was told about my post that everything pertaining to nurses' distribution, the hours, the job assignments, would be solely under my control. We left 1 week after my appointment, and on our way we stopped at Marseille, France, where I purchased from our own funds a large stock of items that we would need. From the dock where we arrived, the barracks hospital was a steep climb along a trail ankle deep in mud and refuge. At last, my band of 38 nurses stood in front of the enormous gateway to the hospital. Later, I suggested that the words that should have been above the door should have been, "Abandon hope, all who enter here." The barracks were shaped in a hollow square with a tower at each corner. The inner courtyard was a sea of mud and filth. One of the four sides had been gutted by fire and was unfit for use. But from the distance, the building was a stately one. Inside, however, I must tell you, it was a loathsome place with muddy walls, broken floors, and a shocking accumulation of foul odors. The description of the London Times was not exaggerated. Conditions were far worse than they had described. There were 4 miles of beds that were arranged throughout the long barracks. Men lay bedridden, almost naked, or in ragged, blood-stiffened uniforms. Broken bones had not been set, and festering wounds had not been dressed. Rats ran over the patients day and night, and vermin dropped from the cracks in the ceiling. Water was limited. Men went 24 hours without a drink of water. Here and there were a few candles stuck in beer bottles to glow dimly for light. Even in the face of this squalor, I was allowed to do nothing. Both my nurses and I had to have the sanction of the approval of the chief medical officer to enter the wards, and the chief medical officer thought that a young society lady and her nurses were the English government's folly. So we were given 6 small rooms for 39 of us. Let me tell you about the rooms. One was a closet. Another was a kitchen. And the third held the body of a dead Russian soldier no one had bothered to remove. Welcome, nurses. I remember that first night well. I lay there trying to sleep, but all I could hear were the rats climbing all around, scurrying. Well, the first week I busied my team of nurses by making shirts, bandages, slings, and pillowcases from the old laundry I had found. The hardest part was to shut my eyes to the cries and the suffering in the barracks. But I had no alternative, for to go to the screaming men would mean disobeying the orders and perhaps risking being sent home. Now, the food situation was interesting. It wasn't at all but like the Holden kitchen. There were only 13 pots to cook food for 2,500 patients. Meat was often raw, and patients ate with their fingers. Though patients were half-starved, many would not touch the unappetizing food. I let the doctors know that I would be happy to feed the sick. Remember the provisions I'd purchased? Some were for the kitchen. And finally, after my persistence, after 10 days, the doctors called on me. Thus, I made a wedge in their wall of resistance. Not as a nurse, though, as a cook. After articles appeared in the London Times regarding the work of my nurses, a collection was taken up and a substantial sum was sent with a man by the name of John McDonald. John asked the ambassador of Turkey what he would do with the money. The ambassador lived in a luxurious home in Constantinople, where the hospital was fully equipped. His idea was to take the money and to build an English church. But John knew that the money had been intended for me to collect and assist with my nurses, so he traveled to Scutari himself and found me. The supplies I had brought were just about exhausted. These funds were a godsend. And even though I loved God passionately, I didn't think building a church was the best use for those funds either. With them, we bought flannel shirts, socks, blankets, pillows, tin cups, plates, soap, and 200 scrub brushes. Then I hired help to clean the barracks floors. The harassed medical staff soon learned that to get something done, they just need to ask me. And using tact, diplomacy, and feminine ingenuity, I had gradually imposed my way on the fearful and the callous hospital officers. I was often told that something could not be done, and I would answer, but it must be done. Suddenly, patients had towels, soap, combs, and toothbrushes. Instead of ill-cooked meat, they had punctual, well-prepared meals to build up their strength. They now ate with clean knives and forks instead of their dirty hands. If you can believe it, the patients' shirts had never been washed at Scutari. When they became too revolting, someone merely would dip them into cold water and left them to dry. I did what seemed only logical. I rented a nearby Turkish home. I installed boilers, and I employed soldiers' wives to do the laundry. The soldiers' wives had been staying in the noisy barracks cellar with no means of support. I did very little. I just saw that the rooms were clean, repaired, and that these good women were put to work. Our men arrived from the battlefield shivering, frostbitten, and gangrene, often typhus-ridden and so near death that they had no strength to complain. I saw our barracks filling nearly to capacity, and so I proposed that the fire damage wing be repaired. I went to see the ambassador, Lord Stratford. Indifferent as he was to human suffering, he could not resist a woman and one who was determined as I was. He authorized 125 working men who a few days later went on strike. The self-absorbed ambassador quit working with me, but I hired 200 men at my own cost. Many wondered about our accommodations, and I brought a picture to show you about what they looked like, and I will be glad to pass it around as I speak. Here it is. Pastor Mona, would you please pass this around? Oh, I forgot to have you dance. We'll do it after. A small storeroom served as my office and my quarters. Behind the screen was a cot where I slept. It had no stove for heat, and rats scampered in and out. I did my many administrative duties from my office, but I was well aware of the primary reason I'd come, and that was to prove the value of women nurses in a military hospital. The military doctors believed that they were above anything that my nurses and I did anyway. Perhaps things haven't changed that much after all. We came to do nursing, but we began by making bandages, scrubbing rat-infested floors, and washing bedding and bed shirts. We proved to the doctors and the military personnel that no work was beneath us, and that is how we got our foot into the door of nursing care. One of my opportunities I had was to be at the side of those who died. I often accompanied soldiers into the operating room, which they dreaded even more than the battlefield. I held their hands during many an operation. Chloroform was rarely used as a sedative. Most often they used no sedative at all. The military doctors believed it was strengthening a soldier's morale to use nothing to lessen the pain. People often asked me how I had the stomach to endure amputations and over 2,000 deaths. My answer was not complex. I simply said, God has called me to this work. And when I was in my teens, and God, who can do anything, always saw me through. Some of the soldiers' problems were very obvious. Many drank out of boredom. So I opened up several reading rooms and recreation rooms. If men read instead of drank, they would often get above themselves. I supplied paper in the reading rooms for the men to write letters home. The men flocked to the reading rooms, sitting quietly. In fact, I would tell you that the library in the British Museum could not be more silent or orderly than one of my reading rooms. Now, I was considered an angel by some of the patients. Some were so appreciative that they would even kiss my shadow when I walked by. They called me the lady with the lamp because I would carry with me a lamp as I would go throughout the barracks at night so I could see the men. However, I was rather caustic with any of who neglected my soldiers, and one of them was Dr. John Hall, who was the chief of the medical staff. I didn't care who was in my way. I acted on my patient's behalf, and I hope if you're a nurse, you do too. And many were not fond of me for just that reason. In the 6 months since my band of nurses had arrived, the hospital barracks had been transformed. Order and cleanliness replaced filth and confusion. The mortality rate had fallen from 42% to 22%. I decided to make a tour of other hospitals in the Crimea. The soldiers were always glad to see me, rushing from their tents and cheering wildly for me. But the medical staff was far less excited to see me. Finally, I became ill with the same fever that many of the soldiers had, and for weeks I was near death with cholera. In October, I was well enough to travel back to Scutari, and I was heartened to find that the hospital functioned well even without me. Now, peace was signed on March 30th, 1856. And my nurses went home in groups. The last patient had gone from the barracks in Scutari, and then I was free to go home. I refused to go home until all the patients had gone. I went home 2 weeks later. The English government wanted me to come home on a man of war ship to a national celebration, but instead, I chose to travel home on a French ship incognito. One evening, my parents and sister were sitting in their Lea Hurst living room, and I walked up the road into my family's arms. In my absence, I had become the most discussed woman in all of England. Soldiers who returned home told me stories that made me larger than life. Poets wrote about me. Peddlers sold portraits of me, and even Queen Victoria sent for me to come see her. We spoke together several times, the Queen and I, discussing nursing and the need for reform in medical care. The postman brought me lots of mail. Families of men whose lives I had affected poured out their gratitude. Men who were dead, their families wrote me. Unknown admirers showered me with gifts and many proposals of marriage. But I did not want the publicity, and I refused all of the invitations. Now, the Crimea had broken my health. That is why I must sit in front of you today, and I really spent the last 50 years of my life in bed. But from my bed, I collected data on existing health conditions in the British Army. In fact, perhaps you know that I was the first person that ever worked with statistics. That was really my love, and I loved working with numbers. I found them fascinating. My aim was no less than the complete reform of the military health administration. You see, in peacetime, twice as many soldiers died in the army because of lack of sanitation and proper medical care. I worked on my books and my articles day and night. Sometimes I would sleep only a couple hours a night. In 6 months, I'd written 1,000 pages called Notes on Matters Affecting the Health, Efficiency, and Hospital Administration of the British Army. This was published in 1858. I had an aunt who came to live with me in London, and she ran errands, and many other devoted people helped me do my work. Eventually, after years of work, the British Army accepted nearly all of my proposals for raising the standards of medical care. And the generous English people gave me a gift of £44,000. Which I used to found the Nightingale School and Home for the Training of Nurses in 1860. I was behind the principles of the school. The rules were strict for conduct. I devised the idea that nurses live in a home under the supervision of a home nurse. My book called Notes on Nursing was published in 1859 and stressed the need for fresh air, for warmth, and for cleanliness. All of these seemed to be such a shock to people, and they seemed so obvious to me. I believe that nurses had to be willing to do anything required of them. A woman who thinks any kind of nursing work beneath her will simply be in the way, I said. And a woman who takes a sentimental view of nursing is, of course, worse than useless. Queen Victoria had a valuable brooch designed for me that cost thousands of pounds. And at the time, the British government presented me with a gift of £250,000, which I used to establish a school for the nurses at St. Thomas Hospital. By 1860, I was confined to my bed, where I continued to do my work. In 1865, I moved to London and into a home of my own. 10 years later, my father died. 6 years later, after him, my mother, and then my sister also died. Without my family, I passed my final years alone. And finally, my eyesight also failed, and I could no longer write. But my greatest honor was given to me in 1907, when England awarded me the Order of Merit. This distinguished honor had never been given to a woman in all of English history. The ceremony took place in my bedroom, and I nodded for my pillows, thank you very much. A few months later, I sank into a coma, and on August 13th, in the year 1910, I died at age 90. 3 months before my death, in New York City, at Carnegie Hall, the 50th anniversary of the Nightingale Training Center was celebrated. The speaker called attention to the fact that in the United States alone, there were over 1,000 nursing training schools, several of them headed by the graduates of the St. Thomas School for Nurses in London, which I had begun. Perhaps God had used my life after all. That was all that I sought. Thank you very much. To end our presentation today, I would like to have my friend, Pastor Mona, lead us in a song and a dance. Okay.
She's so inspiring. She tells us about all these great women. And we were passing this book around up here, and it's called Nothing Less Than Greatness. And that made me think that all of us can be great. And when she was telling that story, all the times that when they would ask Florence Nightingale why she was doing what she was doing, she would say because of her feeling of being called to do it. So the dance that I wanted to do today is about us being called and where that comes from. It comes from God. And so that when we're filled with God's spirit, then we're able to become the great people that God wants us to become. And sometimes that might not seem like great, you know, with authority or in a high position, but something like Florence Nightingale was doing, where she was serving other people. So I know all of you know this song, Spirit of the Living God. Probably know that, right? Mm-hmm. But we'll sing it first, and then, you know, it's easy. Spirit of the Living God, fall fresh on me. Spirit of the Living God, fall fresh on me. Melt me, mold me, fill me, use me, Spirit of the Living God, fall fresh on me.
So now you have to sing while I dance.
Spirit of the Living God, fall fresh on me. Spirit of the Living God, fall fresh on me.
Well, you have to do it with me. You have to do it with me. Everybody stand up.
Okay. Here we go.
We can all invite the Spirit to fall on us and fill us with the Spirit so that we can become what God wants us to become.
Spirit of the Living God, fall fresh on me. Spirit of the Living God, fall fresh on me. Melt me, mold me, fill me, use me, Spirit of the Living God, fall fresh on me.
Spending the most lovely day we've seen at Holden Village inside with Florence Nightingale. And go home and clean your rooms.
You're welcome.
You did good with that.
You see how she dressed up?